Thank you, Vern. It's a pleasure for me to bring our speaker today. We've tried to find a wide diversity of speakers, and I hope we've done it one more time. First, I want to say hi to Allison's husband who came. He's a retired bird colonel from the Air Force. Rob? Okay. Our speaker today was in the first class at the Air Force Academy. That was a class of 1980. In that class, 153 were in that class, of which 98 were women, of which 25 became pilot qualified, and she was one of the 25. That got her off to a good start. I think she is a reasonably headstrong lady. I learned that yesterday afternoon. When she told me what she was going to talk about, so I hope I hope we're all going to learn something. Okay, she wanted to be a pilot. They had her over in some desk job, and she met with this committee that was picking pilot trainees. And she was very persistent. I learned that yesterday afternoon when the three of us met. Colonel Rob shaking his head. She did move up to where she got the highest ratings possible, and when she was training as a co-pilot and then a pilot and became pilot qualified. As you may have seen in what we sent out to you, she has over 1,500 rating in the cockpit, 1,500 hours, which is quite an accomplishment. Now, what did she do? Well, she moved on after retirement. She didn't have enough to do, so she accepted a position as an undersecretary in the Veterans Affairs. Why would you volunteer to do something like that? I see a lot of people shaking their heads, and I'll bet if we ask every veteran here to stand up, half the men would probably stand up, and they might shake their head at the same time. What she was is Undersecretary for Benefits, and under her command, she had over 20,000 employees reporting up to her, 20,000, and the budget was $95 billion. That's not million, that's billion dollars. She's shaking her head, yes. So I think what I would like to do quickly is sit down and shut up and let her have all the time that remains. So join me in a warm welcome.
Well, good afternoon. Okay, so let's do this real quickly. Veterans in the room. Wow. Thank you for your service. Okay, yeah. So let's do the next one that I really care about. How many family members, spouses of a veteran? There's a couple. Good. Get them up nice and high. Thank you for your sacrifice. And then how many people have no veterans in their family, no military members serving, but they just support veterans and military members? That should be every hand in the room. Let's get them up high. Thank you for your patriotism. So let me start first. Thank you, David. I appreciate your kind words and our fun conversations, and also conversations with your beautiful bride, Ann, as well. I also want to thank you all, by the way, for inviting a couple years ago my very dear friend, Lieutenant General Sue Helms. And if you were here for that one, she was the astronaut. Boy, is she, okay, excuse my French, and I am going to seminary part-time, but she is badass! And I'm loving that the Marvel movie is getting ready to poke out, and they're going to have a woman who went to the Air Force Academy, because that's where I went to, so looking forward to that as well. But she just done some really amazing things, and I'm so proud to call her a friend. I want to thank you, say thank you to your president and president-elect, Vern Istok. Did I get that right, Vern and Judy? And to Joe Fogg, and your, I don't know where Joe was sitting. There you are, Joe, right in front of me. Thank you. And to your executive director, Ellie Creer, for all the support you all did for us to get us here today. We both, Rob and I both really appreciate it. I also want to acknowledge the terrific young women that spoke here before from Pace School. I'm just going to say this, and this is off script, but, you know, when you have those kind of barriers in front of you and you fight through them to get to a higher level, unlike a lot of kids have to do in life, darn, I want to hire you. And I heard a lot of you wanted to be in the healthcare business. Please let me know when you apply for a VA job. I will write your recommendation. All right? So I also want to acknowledge something else important today. Because, yes, I was in the first class at the Air Force. Not the very first class. I'd look quite a bit older if I was in the very first class. But I was in the first class of women that went to the Air Force Academy. And they opened the doors in 76, and I graduated in 1980. I've done a lot of things as a woman, who you can put in the first category. There's too many, or I'd give the whole speech on that. And I don't want to do that because I don't want this to be about me. But what I will tell you is we women needed, like I did here earlier today, we need to support one another and stand up for one another. And International Women's Day, celebrate one another, all of the women here in the room today. But not only that, I had tremendous male mentors as well. And none of us get here without others helping us. So all the men in the room, mentor young women as well as young men. They need your help and they need your guidance and they need your direction as well. Okay, so I feel like at this point in time I should start this story with the proverbial once upon a time. And yes, I did get the question that said, why are you taking that job, Allison? And I'm going to tell you something. Of the 377,000 employees in the Veterans Administration, large portion of them will tell you because there is no more noble mission. And I believe that, and I live that, and besides that, I had a faith calling to go there, so that's why I went, and that's why I stayed. So, that said, I'm going to tell you the story because I want to see if I can help you to know and understand VA by doing a couple of things. I'm going to understand, do you know how VA looks? There's three sort of administrations. There's the Veterans Health Administration that does all the medical care. There's the Veterans Benefit Administration, that's what I led, that has like eight different business lines of non-medical benefits. You know them, you've heard of them. Disability compensation, pension, fiduciary support for our veterans who need help managing their money because they can't manage it on their own because of their disability. All the education programs, including GI Bill, tremendous benefit, by the way. I'm leveraging it to go to seminary. The VA home loan program for any of you people who are involved in mortgage or real estate or banking. We manage one of the largest portfolios of VA home loans and in the trillions of dollars when you add up all the mortgages. And when you do that, by the way, we guaranteed those loans at 25%, making those very interesting and advantageous to people who wanted to loan veterans the money to buy a home and live out the American dream. And then we also had a life insurance program, one of the largest as well, not only ours, but we also managed DOD's life insurance program and vocational rehabilitation and employment. And the last one was the transition program where we helped veterans come across. We stood that one up during my watch. But I want you to know, sort of see how sausage is made in VA, specifically on the benefits side. I'm going to mention a little bit about health care towards the end. I really want you to understand this issue. The cost of war doesn't end when they come off the battlefield or they step out of uniform. It doesn't end. So when we're thinking about the investment we're going to make as a nation, we need to consider the cost of war that comes for the less than 1% who will serve and defend this country and our obligation to pay that and to take care of them for the rest of their lives. I will also, I want you to also frankly see, I'm going to tell you a story about a great success story in government. And I know some of you are a little cynical. I heard a little bit about that earlier in some of our meetings. But I want you to hear a great one that I don't think you've heard. And so I want you to hear it. But in the process of telling that, you'll understand more about VA and you'll understand more about the benefits and what our veterans experience going through. So back to once upon a time. June the 6th, 2011. Anniversary of D-Day, claiming the victory forward. I landed on the beach of the Veterans Benefit Administration, where more than how many? Half a million veterans disability compensation claims were languishing. And what do I mean by languishing? They were waiting on average 302 days for a decision. And those decisions were coming out with a not very high quality level, about 83%. Not good by anybody's standards, not good for veterans, not good for their families, and by the way, not even good by all the employees who are working on those things day in and day out. You know why? Because 53% of the employees in the Veterans Benefit Administration, that 20,000 plus number you heard about, are veterans themselves. They want to serve veterans. And by the way, another 45% of them are a direct family member of a veteran. You know, husband, wife, mother, father, son, daughter. Direct family member. Only 2% are sort of in that patriot group, but they're there because they want to make a difference. They feel like that's their way of serving, since they did not. So, but you know what they were doing? They were sitting there. Sorry, I didn't even notice that was standing there. They were sitting there with little rubber fingertips on your fingers. You've seen that before? Sifting through 5,000 tons of paper in a year. Every year, 5,000 tons. You know what that looks like? I'll give you a description of that. That's 10 Mount Everest stacked end to end on top of each other in a single year. If you don't get Mount Everest and you know how high it is, I got a better one for you. 200 Empire State Buildings, end to end. They had to sift through that kind of paper in a single year. You think that might explain why the average is 302 days? Well, there's more. So let me tell you a little bit more about what was going on. You might remember, by the way, a picture that rang around the world in a news article at some point in time, which had one of our offices, Winston-Salem Regional Office. You saw these great big, almost to my neck, tall file cabinets. And then on top of that, they had another size of a small toddler, you know, stacked of paper claim folders on top of that. And it was buckling the floor underneath it such that we had to take emergency action to get all those claims out of there and shore up the floor. That was the issue, how much paper they were doing. And they were dealing with all these claims that literally can be this thick, and my hands are showing, you know, maybe 12, 18 inches thick. No real IT. For all those who do business, you tell me how you'd like to do something like this with no real IT, no automation with rules-based engines in them, no ways to put prompts in the system to remind you you've got to do that before you do this. All the great ways that IT has helped enable and make people more efficient and effective in business today did not exist when I showed up in 2011. Did not exist. And they were also, by the way, having to memorize, another thing was about 4 to 5 reams of paper tall, was their rule book. 850 diagnostic medical codes. These are not medical people. These are administrative people. Not medical people, even, you know, when you first walk in, you're learning. I think I get a medical, you know, undergraduate degree at this point from having served 5 years there. But 850 of them over to all 15 body systems. And then they had to sift through that book to find out how you judged by law the disability level of each one of those medical issues of 850 diagnostic codes. There was no search engine on an online system that lets you say, you know, whatever the, you know, pick a medical thing you're thinking right now that you deal with. There was no way to search that. It was literally eyeballs and fingers reading and flipping and reading and flipping. They, by the way, also had to search for and ask for repeatedly Department of Defense medical records and private medical records because the law says they have to have evidentiary information in order to grant the claim. Guess how long that took? 150 days on average. 150 days to find those things, and that's the foremost piece of evidentiary record you need to make that decision. So I will also say, just prior to my arrival, the secretary at the time, Secretary Shinseki, had set a standard that said no claim older than 125 days. Not an average, no claim older than 125 days. And 150 of them was spent looking for medical records. Not even doing the rest of our work to make sure the claim was done right and adjudicated right. And by the way, here's another big one. Students in the room, and frankly, maybe even some of you who have these experiences. The people in the process, there are different people from the end-to-end process, but one in the middle that does the most significant work in terms of adjudicating the claim is something called a rater. And I will tell you, they were writing from scratch 3 10-page term papers a day. There was no automated letter generating capability, pulling data from here and there and populating it in fields that would print it all out and let them know what the final decision was. They were literally writing it themselves, 10 pages. Not a pretty place. So that's sort of the environment, how they were working. But here's what also is important for you to know, because this continues. There was an unprecedented demand at the time. 10 years we had been at war then. We are 18 years at war now. Positive thing was people in today's war are 10 times more likely to survive their illness and injury of war than were their previous counterparts in other wars. Why? Because the battlefield medicine has just gotten that good. So amen to that. That's positive. But the other side of it is they are coming back and needing disability compensation, not on a couple of issues, but on a lot of issues. And so that was important to know. They also were returning at that time to a really tough economy. Granted, now it's better, and now we have people out there as a result of a lot of work we did with industry to get them to take responsibility for helping inspire them to hire veterans and focus on it. But at the time, that had not occurred, and it was a tough time to find a job if you were a veteran. In addition, Secretary Shinseki had made a courageous decision to add 3 new Agent Orange conditions to for our Vietnam veterans. Any Vietnam veterans in the room? Welcome home. Welcome home. But let me tell you what it does. It added 260,000 claims to an inventory that was about that big. So it doubled the inventory overnight in October of 2010. That doubling, by the way, 4 months later, 125 days, meant 500,000 claims in backlog almost instantaneously. Now, I say all that, but I want you to know something and hear me very loud and clear. It was the right thing to do. And we knew it would be tough. The last thing, the other thing he did was relax the rules on post-traumatic stress disorder. And let me give you a picture of what it was like before he relaxed the rules. If you were filing for post-traumatic stress disorder, you have to get the diagnosis, yes, but you also had to have the historical data that validated your story about where you got it. So you had to go to DOD and ask DOD for documentation that I was in this place on this day when this thing happened, and guess what? That just is almost an impossible request. Didn't happen. So he said, you don't have to do that anymore. We just have to know you were at war. And if we know you were at war, then we're going to assume you were exposed to something that gave you PTSD. Now all you need is the diagnosis. So that's what he did. The outcome of that, I'll give you by example again. 1993, when the rule didn't exist that way, after Desert Shield, Desert Storm, we had 40,000 veterans on the compensation rolls for PTSD. When I left in 2015, after the new rule and after we invited people all the way back to World War II to come in, we had 800,000 people on the PTSD rolls for VA. And today, I bet it's up over 1 million. Now, that's a really good thing because we've got people now getting compensated for and getting care for something that we really have to pay attention to because of its connections to mental health and sadly, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this at the end, but suicide prevention. He added 9 more Gulf War syndrome illnesses. Yes, it added additional claims, but the right thing to do. But it's just, you see, it was a bit of a perfect storm here. And let me tell you also, we saw something else happen. There's a different behavior that's going on across generations in terms of compensation filing and things like that for VA and needing for healthcare in VA. So I'll describe it this way. A World War II veteran, a lot of them, but only 12% of them ever filed a claim, and they maybe put 3 or 4 medical issues inside the claim. Today's veteran files, 99% of them file, and they put 16.2 medical issues in the claim. 99% at 16.2, 12% at 4. There's a big difference in behavior. Part of it was outreach. We were doing a lot more of that because of what came out of the Walter Reed problem with the healthcare, taking care of some of those folks that came back to the hospital, but still a problem. By the way, when we grant medical issues inside claims, and that's what, you know, I've been talking about, that also gives those people access to a secondary level benefit they can apply for, and those exploded. And guess what it also did? It gave them access for those medical conditions, now service connected to the hospital administration they didn't have access to before. Because there's a little bit of a confusion in all this. Everybody thinks all veterans entitled to get health care at VA. Service connected issues, and there is a 1 to 8 category of people, and it's also means tested as well. So there's a, you know, how much money you make kind of thing as well. And your disability level goes into that too. So you have in front of you a paper I left on your seats. I want to just point to you. You can see this visually. If you look at the slide, page one, slide one at the top, you see something that looks like a mountain? And you see it peaks up there in March of 2013. And then it comes screaming down. That was the backlog. You can see the impact of everything I just described to you on the climb, that steep climb, especially the Agent Orange. You can see a really steep slope in there. And then you see this massive decline on the backside. And you're going to ask yourself, what happened in that process? And that's what we're going to talk a little bit about. But basically, in March of 2013, we took 611,000 claims that were in backlog, older than 125 days, down to 71,000 claims in backlog. And I will tell you, of those 71,000, it is, in most cases, appropriate they are still in backlog because it's a complexity of a case. It's a, I live in Michigan in the summer and Florida in the winter. I'd rather have my Michigan doctor, you know, fill out these forms and go back to my Michigan hospital to do that. So can you wait? And we say yes, obviously. So those are some of the reasons why some of those are still in backlog. But before we transformed, and I'll tell you how we did it, in 2009, the employees were only able to adjudicate, make a decision on, 2.74 million medical issues inside 980,000 claims. 2.74, 980. After we transformed in 2015, the same employees adjudicated 6.35 million medical claims versus 2.4, and 1.4 million claims versus 980,000. Putting 500,000 more veterans into the veterans' compensation rolls and access to VHA health care just in that short period of time. So how do we do it? I call it a transformation plan that included people, process, and technology. And at the end of the day, another spoiler alert, helped us eliminate 73% of the time out of the process. For those of you who run business, that's a pretty good deal, right? And how about how you feel about 81% more productivity out of your employees? Pretty good thing. Yeah, I felt really great about what our employees had done and how they rolled in and followed us on this path. So people, I'm not going to go through all the ideas or Dave will have the hookup here on me, but we had a bunch of different things we did to help change the way they were organized and trained to do their work. Before, they'd been sitting, all like functions stacked together. We said that's not how a veteran experiences the claim. They experience a claim from end to end. Let's put the person who does the first part with the person who does the second part with the person who does the third part and the person who does the fourth part all in one team and make them a cross-functional team. And we did that. Then we said, you know, it doesn't make sense that all these really hard, complex, really difficult claims are going to the brand new guy because the older guys know how to pick, cherry pick them out of the pot a little better and they don't pick the hard ones. We said, nope, done with that. We're going to break them into segmented lanes like you go to the grocery store. You know, you got an express lane, just one or two medical issues. Let's get you through there and not have you kind of in the main process. Then we said, okay, you got a really complex one. We're going to put you over here in our special operations lane. And in that lane, we're going to make sure that we put our very best, highest experienced people doing those claims. And in the middle is just, you know, not too hard to do, but there's just a few more. So we put the rest of the folks in that one. We, for the first time, and if you're a military person, had any military experience, you're going to go, really? We did not have any standardized training, not like your DOD experience. You had to have standard MOS training before you were allowed to pick up the equipment and operate the mission, right? Not here. They had local-based training. It was all haphazard. We created standard training. You didn't get to touch a claim until, depending on what job you had, between 6 and 8 weeks after you went through the training. And that made a huge difference in the preparation for our employees and the standardization of our processes. We also took quality people and put them in. If you've been a quality person and paid attention to this, you know quality doesn't come at the end or you have a cost of poor quality issue. We put them at key places. We knew we made mistakes. And if we found a mistake and took it back to the person, we said, it's a mulligan, all you golf guys that play on the course. That means you get to not, it doesn't count against you if you fix it right now, and that became a huge incentive to our employees to fix things and learn from that decision. So then we had to process things. We took 600 ideas that came from every stakeholder you could imagine, even the outside world, and we asked them what we could do to improve it. And they gave us 600 ideas. We couched those all together and found out about 40 of those ideas were appropriate, and so we started working on those. And we did an awful lot of Lean Six Sigma process improvements, pilot tested it, and all the rest, and had our labor partners heavily unionized, yes. Had our labor partners on those teams piloting, and had our veteran service organizations, you know, the DAVs and VFWs and the Legions and all the rest working with us. So that was the processes. And then we took the people ideas we had and the process ideas, and we said, let's build some requirements for the new technology. And built the first ever large veterans benefit management system at VA that was the end-to-end IT solution. I can tell you it has rules-based engines in it. It has prompts. All those things I described in the front they didn't have, they now have. But it also required us, by the way, that's no more 10-page term papers a day, because we also built in a way that it produced an automated letter based on the results. But we had to do something else. Remember all that 5,000 tons of paper I shared with you? We had to turn that into digits. That meant we had to go into a massive scanning ingest capability. We scanned 99.9% of all the paper we used to support it, including redirecting the mail into a central scanning site, turning that into digits, associating that with every single veteran's e-file. And as of today, every one of you, even though you aren't in today's, you may have never filed a claim, you now have an electronic folder. Anything you ever send to VA is going to go into your electronic folder. So that's where we were. And that's 3 billion images when I left, and they're at many more than that now. Bottom line, that paper and mail is all gone. The floors aren't buckling anymore. The Records Management Center, which was like football fields long that stored all these records, is empty. They've done it all. They scanned it all. And now we're avoiding, I think this is an outdated number at the time. When I was there, $22 million a year on storage and mailing and printing costs. I think it's much higher now they're saving because you're not moving it, you're not transiting it, you're not losing it. So that's all good. And remember that 4 to 5 reams of a book they had to learn all that stuff from and find? It's now a knowledge management technology capability. They put in the Google word, it finds it, points it at them, and they can get right from the Veterans Benefit Management System to get it. We also built a VA portal called eBenefits. How many of y'all have an eBenefits account? Okay. I'm not moving to Florida, Dave, unless you get them all an eBenefits account. I'll send you a thing that tells them how to do it. Okay. But it's a joint DOD and VA system and has 60-plus self-service features. So now we add another lane to the grocery store. Thank you. And it's the self-serve lane where you do it yourself. And there are a lot of people competent to do that and want to do that. So we did that as well. When I arrived, there were 250,000 users on it. When I left, there were over 5 million users on it. In the last year, there's now over 6 million users on it. So get your eBenefits account. By the way, you can get immediate access to your loan guarantee letter that allows you to get a mortgage using your loan guarantee letter. You have to file for your education benefits online. And then you can track when your education benefits pay. You can track all your compensation, all your checks and everything else. It's just a good place to go to know what's going on. So if that's a litany of other projects. We also built a national call center. It was frustrating, I know. I sat on the end of it and got drop called more times when I tried to test the system. But we finally got through the pain, built a state-of-the-art national call center that matches industries, frankly, on the scores that scores well with public call center or private call centers. They now answer 4.1 million calls a year, and they have a drop call rate of less than 1%. So I'm not going to tell you more of those kinds of ideas, though I have a lot more, because David would be, like I said, back at me. But I have a word of caution, and this takes to your thoughts as citizens of this country. I have a word of caution that has been whispered to me by many, and it's a byproduct of successful transformation, and that is the growth of overall veteran non-medical benefits from $72 billion when I arrived to $95 billion when I left, and this year it was $104 billion. Now, for those of you who know and understand budget, you know discretionary, non-discretionary. Discretionary is what funds the staffs and special projects. Non-discretionary is like Social Security. You have to pay it. You can't decide you don't want to pay it. But the bigger that pot grows, the more pressure on the discretionary type. And I will tell you that By the way, for VA, 3 cents on the dollar is what we did to distribute $95 billion worth of budget, and that went directly into the hands of a veteran. But I will say, even 4 years ago, members of Congress who, in a hearing, would scold me for not going faster and doing more for veterans and giving them more, would privately come off the stage after the hearing and say, "You got to be careful. You know, we're putting a lot of money in mandatory on that mandatory budget, and we got to be careful." And so if they're talking about it, you know others are talking about it. And I will tell you, my response was always, "Hey, I'm sorry. That 1%, less than 1% of veterans and family members earned every dollar." But you know what? I understood their point, and I think that's a debate that will come at some point. The 500,000, by the way, new veterans on the disability rolls swamped the Veterans Health Administration, VHA. Remember, 2013 was the day it peaked and started coming screaming down? Guess where it went screaming to? VHA and the medical side. Even though they are the largest integrated healthcare system, providing care at 1,250 sites, healthcare facilities, and taking care of 9 million enrolled veterans each year, with about 58 million medical appointments. That's, by the way, up 3.7 million since 2014 when the crisis occurred. It, which, by the way, was never a quality of care crisis. It was always an access crisis. And guess who was flooding by all the good stuff we did on one side, the other side? And I just want you to know that. I will tell you, though, the quality of care, they consistently rate higher than many others in all 11 categories that the industry-wide healthcare business does. You can look at a recent Dartmouth study done recently and see how they're rated. And an AMA just published a study that says wait times are shorter significantly at VHA as well. They've also done a couple of other things. You can now get increased care in the community. And I think they've got the right balance now between care in the community and care in VA. They also put the decision on where you go in the hands of the right person, which is the veteran. So I think that's a positive thing. They have a significant growth they've done in telehealth, and I will tell you, I think they actually are leading the nation in telehealth applications. They've hired more mental health and other practitioners and more clinic space to house them. And they've implemented same-day appointments for primary care and mental health. How many of you can remember when you needed to see a doctor and you couldn't get in that day and it took you, you know, a little bit longer to do? So that all said, if I sound like VA's cheerleader, guilty. I'm guilty. But maybe it's because I've been in the inside and I see the hearts and passion and drive that that organization has to do the right thing by veterans. And so I will say also, though, but when you process 6 million medical issues on the VBA side, even at 96% quality, you still make mistakes. And when you serve more than 9 million veterans with 58 million medical appointments, you still miss some you should have gotten. And when you're a student veteran dependent on your stipend to live while you go to school and the stipend's wrong or it doesn't come, that's a big deal. Frankly and sadly, when you have more than 377,000 employees, not all of them do the right thing. If you've been a business owner, you know what that bell curve looks like. So in closing, I would like you to ask you to do a favor. It's probably the first time you've ever been asked to do this in your life of listening to people chit-chat with you. If you have a phone, I'd like you to pull it out right now. And this time doesn't count against me, Dave. Okay, if you don't want to pull your phone out or you can't pull your phone out or it's too much, you have a piece of paper in front of you that's got four different slides on it. The last one there. Do this, please, as soon as you get a quiet minute, with your phone. Please do this. Put this phone number in. It is the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. 1-800-273-8255. And if you are a veteran, press 1. If you are not a veteran, stay and listen to the other robocall tell you which button to push, because it is the National Suicide Prevention Line. And you can, by the way, on the veteran one, it's completely anonymous. We have a lot of military, currently serving military members that call it because it's anonymous. But if we can save their lives, too, then we're going to do that. Or you can text now, 838-255, or you can chat online, 24/7, 365. So probably some of you are thinking, well, I don't really know any young veterans. I'm not probably going to run into this problem, so I don't really need to put this in my phone. You know young people, right? This is an epidemic in our country. You know young people, right? And by the way, for our students, you must put this in, and you must share it on your Facebook site, so you must get your friends to put it in their phone, because I know this firsthand. When you need it, you do not have time to look it up. I cannot even count the number of times I was on the other end of a phone with a suicidal veteran, or the other end of my email, and I'm the only one on it with a suicidal veteran. Please be part of the solution. We need everybody on this effort. And by the way, looking around the room today, you think it's probably all the young guys and young women. And by the way, women suicide as a military member is up, completed suicide. You know why? Because they've learned to do things like their male counterparts in the service, and they use lethal methods. Before, they didn't used to use lethal methods. Now women veterans use guns to kill themselves just like males, and therefore they are higher in the completion category than men. Not than men, but than other women outside the military. Okay, but looking around the room, did you know that 65% of those veterans who complete suicide are over the age of 65? So, put this number in your phone. Look around at the young guys and make sure they're okay, but look around at each other and make sure you're okay. And by the way, if that number doesn't help you help someone else, I'm almost willing to bet a paycheck, but I don't pay myself much now in my own business. I take care of veterans who want jobs. That's what I do. But I'd almost be willing to bet there's somebody in this room that might need that number someday to save their own life. So, all in conclusion, I don't want to leave you on a low note, but I want to leave you on a high note to say there's a lot of good going on. There's a lot of people trying to take care of veterans. Businesses have come alongside us with heavy encouragement from us all to provide jobs and to engage them and to teach them and to train them. And with all of that, I think we're going the right direction. But again, I want to thank you all for the invitation. Thank you for inviting me here. I think I'm the only VA person who's ever been here, so I feel kind of special. We'll see after the questions. But I've answered a lot of tough questions. I'm not afraid of them, so go ahead and ask them. I also gave you my contact information. I am on LinkedIn. And while I'm no longer at VA and I can't speak for them, I can't help push your claim to the top or any of those kinds of things. If I can ever help you navigate a benefit, just hit me up on the email, and I'll see if I can plug you into the right person to ask or the right person to do it. But I also tell you, go out to your Veterans Service Organization officers, because they are really good at helping you do that as well. Please feel free to reach out to me. So that said, I just, with sincere heart, say God bless you all, and all those who have served, and all those who have served, continued to serve around the country and the globe, and for their families, and especially for their survivors. Thank you.
Before I get to the questions, and we do have a few of them, we won't be able to cover all of them, but as our members know, we like to reward our speakers with memories of Naples and Marco Island in this area. So someplace, here it is.
Oh, thank you.
Here's
that's
a
beautiful
book for you on Naples, and here's one of our members that donates books to us on Marco Island.
Wonderful.
You can take home with you.
I will, and Rob wants to look at them because he wants to go driving around and see if we should move here.
Yeah. Well, we had that discussion yesterday afternoon, and I got in the middle of it. And when I informed the general that now that she's been a speaker, she moves to the top of our list of over 300 that want to join our club. So I'm trying to help him, but I'm getting beat up on by her, okay?
I got grandbabies in Northern Virginia. Y'all get that, right?
Well, you know how to fly an airplane.
Yeah, that way.
Okay. I want to ask a question first, if you don't mind. It's been about 2 weeks ago. There was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and the title of it was Veterans Are Freer to Choose. And included in that, it said, look who's objecting to faster access in private health care. Who do you think's objecting? Well, the politicians, because they would lose some control on VA healthcare. And that's the heart of the editorial. Would you have any comments about
that,
please?
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So how many got your pneumonia vaccine this year or last year or some year recently? Do you know where that was invented? VA. How many of y'all had a smoking habit, wanted to break it, and needed to break it, and therefore did some addiction stuff with all the products they're on today. You know who invented that or created that and did that? VA. How many of you all know somebody with a prosthetic that that has gotten better and better and better in helping them be more and more mobile? VA. How many of you know PTSD and its discussion in the medical community is largely led by VA? TBI, partnering even with the National Football League and others who have high-contact sport arenas, largely led by VA. And I could give you a laundry list of other things that VA does that are pretty significant to our overall health responses across the nation. It's a national treasure. So one of the things I will tell you, and I just had this conversation, in fact, last night with some leaders in VHA and VA, I think they've got it about right. I think that they've got now enough care in the community and enough VA care, and the veteran gets to make the choice that it's about right. I will tell you, when we first released, when we first went into that, a lot of veterans went out and they came back. And why they came back was they found out that wait times are wait times are wait times because the healthcare industry has that problem. Never made enough primary care doctors. There's no incentive to be a primary care doctor. You don't get paid as much as a specialist. And schools are not incentivized to do that because you don't get paid as much. But they get to choke points on primary care, which is why VA has built up its primary care capability to break some of those choke points. I think they've got it about right. I think when you read articles in the paper like this, and I will tell you, I've gotten good at knowing when things are a little bit inflated and when things are a little bit, you know, skewed. VA is not fighting the balance. Members of Hill are not really fighting the balance right now on both parties, both sides. What they are fighting against is there are some interested stakeholders that would like to see close down VA and convert it all into private care. You want to see your wait times in private care go up with some of the 16.2 medical issues on each one of these veterans we have out there in the system? There are states that have actually tested some of that, and it swamps them. And there is something about going into a VA facility if you've been a member of the military. It's full of experiences and wonderful memories on the walls and recognition of military people, and you just sort of feel like you're kind of back in the fold. And some of our veterans really need that. So I would just say I think they got it about right now. I think there's a good balance. But I would even be opposed to a complete shutdown of VA. It's a national treasure. You don't want to do that to yourself. It's just too good at what it does, and there are too many veterans that have a good experience there.
Okay, I have about three or four of the same question. Should young women be required to register with Selective Service?
Okay, so you're talking to a 27-year Air Force veteran, married to a 30-plus or whatever he is, Air Force veteran, who's got a son in the Army. My daughter, our whole family has done public service. I will tell you that. We are all a family about public service and taking care of people and doing the things you need us to do. But 22% of the United States Air Force are women now. Every field, I think there's one small field somewhere that's closed to women, but all the others are open to women, and they are all doing really well in most cases in those career fields. I'll tell you, I would not have made it to the Air Force Academy if I was doing it now, because these women are strong, and they are capable and all the rest. But Selective Service.
And persistent.
Yeah, let's go to Selective Service. And persistent. You know, I'm gonna do the typical political media meeting and shift you just a little on the discussion. I believe every single person that's a member of this country ought to do a commitment to public service.
Yeah, I got it.
And you know this from some of the people you saw who entered service with you. Not everybody's cut out for military service. Not everybody's, So let's get them doing something that has them know that they need to love their country and give back or pay forward what they will experience as a result of their country. And I do believe in sort of that kind of a role and mission. You're going to ask me about that one. Okay, as a 27-year veteran, yes, I think women in general might be okay. No, I have sons that didn't get called into the military under a draft. We have enough volunteers right now that I don't think that would ever be too weird. I've just seen a lot of women just do an extraordinarily good job. And some of them it might be a good idea. I don't know. I haven't heard enough about the current approach. So And I see a few heads nodding left and right, meaning no. And I'm obviously putting this in respect to my, you know, my experiences. So I put that on the table.
Okay, here's a non-controversial question. What has President Trump done about the VA, okay?
I will not comment on anything any president did. I didn't talk about any other president did, right?
Nope.
So I just will not do that. I would say just, you know, you see notes, you see articles. I'd say just, well, and you, I'm not going to comment. I didn't comment and mention
right.
any other president.
We promised you that.
I just try to stay out of it. They're all working. Everybody works hard. This is not an easy task for anyone. There is no secretary on either side of every administration that's tackled this thing that has not been under fire. And one of the things I will say that is something I do know and recognize, having been inside the loop, it doesn't matter what party you're in, because the next time the other party's in there, the other side will switch and start shooting at you. So it's a mutual kind of situation that exists. And I think it exists for this reason. I think it exists because we have, rightfully so, a bad memory we're trying to erase and a moral imperative that we're trying to do, that we never again treat our veterans like we did after Vietnam War. And I think, and by the way, leading that charge, from my opinion, are Vietnam veterans that want to say never again. So I think, frankly, it's just a tough environment to be in, because even if you're 96% people satisfied, you got, you know, 4% who aren't, and they probably have a legitimate reason for not being, and they feel that pain. And by the way, it shows up in the news, and it shows up on the media. And I'll give you a quick little anecdote. I asked a media guy one time, why is it you never talk about all the good things we're doing? And he said, well, it's kind of like this. I never tell a story about all the airplanes that land safely either. And that's an appropriate comment. So I think that that's a little bit why. And I just won't comment on the rest. I think, by the way, everybody who focuses on suicide prevention is a positive thing. And you can tell by my heart, I've been through too many of those tough conversations. And I think anybody, but by the way, everybody that I can look back to has been trying to get a handle on this issue. It's a tough problem to solve.
With that, I do have more questions, but I think we've run out of time, and I want to thank you again for joining us today and educating us about the VA.
Thank you very much.